We shall turn now to the Word of God, to the Book of Job. The Book of Job, chapter 1, and we shall read from verse 12. Job, chapter 1, from verse 12. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. And there was a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a messenger unto Job and said, The oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, The fire of God is fallen from heaven and hath burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, The Chaldeans made out three bands and fell upon the camels and have carried them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead, and I only am escaped alone to tell thee. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped and said, Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. And may the Lord again add his blessing to this reading of his word. And as enabled, we continue to consider Job's experiences under the sovereign hand of God. Last week, we concentrated on Job himself, why he was held up by God, even to Satan, as most exemplary for his godliness. And we noted the various characteristics that are mentioned regarding Job and his reputation, even in the kingdom of darkness. Satan had already measured Job up, and not only did Job have a reputation with God, but he even had a reputation for godliness with Satan himself. Satan can recognize godliness. Satan knows the genuine article. That's something we should never forget in an age of confusion. The devil isn't confused. Whoever else is, he is not. He's not confused about what godliness is, what constitutes true godliness. He could recognize it in Job. Whatever he thought the reason for it was, he could recognize it. And so, when Satan is called to account, God asks him, Hast thou considered my servant Job? And of course he had. He'd been going up and down, walking up and down through the earth, and he had been giving a lot of attention to Job. But as in verse 10, the adversary said, hast thou not made an hedge about him and about his house and about all that he hath on every side, and hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. You've been very good to him. It's very easy for Job to worship God. It's very easy for Job to be pious and to be religious when we consider all the way that he's been blessed and favored by God, all his wealth and all his influence, going back to verse 3, so that this man at the end of the verse was the greatest of all the men of the East. And there's a tendency perhaps to think, well, this was because of his all the various livestock that he possessed. He was very wealthy as far as that was concerned. But there was more to it than that. In a certain way, Job was a ruler. He not only was wealthy materially in his culture and in his society. You hear today, you hear reference to the Emirates, and you think naturally of a particular kind of kingdom ruled by an emir. And that's what Job was. Job was a very significant character in the land of Uz. He had power, he had influence as well as wealth, and that is part of the reason undoubtedly that these three comforters, these three friends come from a distance, because Job was one of those who was recognized as a great man in society. So when Satan is taking note of him, he goes about as a roaring lion, whom he may destroy, whom he may devour. He has a problem with Job, because he said to God, hast not thou made a hedge about him? It was as though Satan had been trying to get at Job, been looking for an opportunity, but he couldn't. He was protected. He was hedged about, and about his house. It's as though I can't even get at his family. I can't even get in, because God's protecting him, and God's protecting his very house, and about all that he hath on every side. You can see the attention that Satan has been given to Job. He knows all about his house. He knows about his wealth. He knows all about everything to do with Job. And it's as though he's been looking for an opportunity. Here's this godly man. If I could tempt him, if I could get at him, if I could bring him down. But he couldn't, because he's protected by God. Doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou set an hedge about him and all that he has? That's why I can't get at him. And maybe sometimes we might feel very confident if we're the Lord's people and think, well, we're getting on, progressing spiritually, and thinking we're improving and increasing in our knowledge, we're not backsliding, we're not slipping like others, we're steadfast. And we have to ask why. Is it because we're particularly strong? Is it because we're more godly, really? Here's what Satan recognized. I can't get at Job because God won't allow me. But, he says, put forth thine hand now, and touch all that he hath, and he will curse thee to thy face. Now you can see the kind of principles that Satan operates upon. He's saying to God, this man Job, you put your hand on him, you afflict him, you send him trouble, and then you'll see just how well he'll pray. You'll see how many sacrifices he'll offer then. You'll see just what's in his heart. Now you go to chapter 2, and after this temptation that we shall look at, when Satan is called the second time into the presence of God to account, God still calls his attention to Job. Well now, you've taken everything from him. Hast thou considered my servant Job? And he'd been considering him. He's taken away his flocks, his herds. He's been observing all the destruction in the experience of Job. And what did he say to God would happen? You touch what he's got, then he'll curse you to your face. And Satan was waiting and looking for this to happen. Instead, what does he witness? Job arose, verse 20, and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. That's not what Satan was expecting to happen. That certainly is not what he wanted to happen. And so God says in verse 3 of chapter 2, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth? There's still none like him. You see, his godliness wasn't depending, Satan, on all his material wealth. His relationship to me is not depending on all the material things that he's enjoyed up until you took them away. The grace and the faith that is in the heart of Job doesn't depend on these things. Hast thou considered him? There's still none like him. In spite of everything you've done, there's still none like him. And he is still one that feareth God and escheweth evil. He's still holding steadfastly to his previous principles. But, and still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him to destroy him without cause. What is God saying to Satan? I have no reason whatever to afflict Job. I have no reason whatever to take anything from him. He's a man of integrity and uprightness, and he fears God and he worships God, and you are trying to set me against this man. You are trying to move me to afflict him, even though I have no cause whatever for doing it. Now, we must keep that in mind as we progress through the book of Job. This is what God says at this very early stage. Still he holdeth fast his integrity, although thou movest me against him. You are trying to force my hand. You are trying to exploit the wealth and the material gain that Job has enjoyed. You are trying to incite me to move against him. I have no reason whatever for doing it. Now, as you go through the book of Job, you find that Job himself is mystified. Why is God doing this? I can't understand it. Because he can't find a reason. Why would God do this? And God is telling Satan, I have no reason to afflict Job, excepting this, the trial of his faith is precious. Now we read there in the first chapter of Peter what he writes, the trial of the faith of God's people is precious, very precious. In verse 6, Peter's writing to the scattered believers, and he says, you rejoice though now for a season of need be, ye are in heaviness. I wonder what a lot of people would do with that. Here's Peter writing to scattered saints, and they're in heaviness. They're burdened. Their lives are filled with heaviness because of trial and temptation through manifold temptations. Not a temptation. Not temptations, plural. But manifold temptations. Temptations that come one on top of the other and cause real heaviness. Weighing heavily upon the spirit, weighing the children of God down. But Peter goes on then, having now spoken of manifold temptations, verse 7, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found. Your faith is tried or tested that it might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. Your faith is being tried, and that's a very precious experience. Now, Peter speaks of the manifold temptations. And at the same time, he's speaking of these temptations as being the trying of their faith, which is necessary to demonstrate and prove that it is genuine. Now, when we go back to the book of Job, what do we find? We find Satan intending to tempt Job. He wants to tempt Job to blaspheme, to tempt Job into denying God, into cursing God. That's what he wants. If I can deal with him severely enough, I'll tempt him through these various incidents and experiences. I will tempt him to curse God. But God, he who knows the end from the beginning, uses the temptation to be a trial of Job's faith and a trial of Job's grace. And when we're going through the book of Job, we are seeing the evidence of real grace. Job couldn't understand what was happening. You go to chapter 23. There, what's Job saying? He knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me. Oh, the devil was tempting him. But God was trying him. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold, I shall come forth purified. I shall even be improved as a result of these trials. So that's what we want to consider here briefly. The Lord said unto Satan, the adversary, that's what it means, behold, all that he hath, all that he hath, no limitations, all that he hath, my Satan must have looked out on it, all the beasts that belong to Job, his camels, his sheep, his oxen, his she-asses, and all his great household, and all his servants, all that he has, his influence, his person, his standing in society, everything that he has. It's in thy power. Imagine. Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. You can do with it what you want. You think that God didn't care about Job? That he would give such a license to Satan? Satan knew what he had. And God says, it's all in your power now. You have the power to do what you want now with what Job has. Job didn't know anything of this. He wasn't privy to this conversation. But this is what God did. And Satan is permitted to tempt Job, who is set up and held up as a most exemplary servant of God. Now, we might well take note of the fact, because sometimes even the godly are tempted to think in very unspiritual ways regarding the dealings of God with them. We noted last week in James, what's written there, ye have heard of the patience of Job. The patience of Job is remarkable and outstanding and exemplary. The grace of patience under the severest trials. We don't read of anyone else from Genesis to Revelation who was tried and tested the way Job was. And yet this is the thing. These severest of trials are the experiences of the most godly man on the face of the earth. What did God say? Hast thou considered him? There is none like him. He's the most godly man. He is the most holy, the most godly man on the face of the earth. Only God could say that. He knew the hearts of all men. There is none like him. And yet, here he is with the severest of all trials. And what would you and I be thinking? Well, if he's been afflicted, it's to make him godly. These are the afflictions of the most godly man that there was. We have a tendency to think God doesn't afflict godly people. It's wayward people. It's backslidden people. It's worldly people. It's those who are his children who are disobedient, who are wandering in their hearts. God has to afflict them. God has to bring them back, as it were, to himself. That's the kind of people he needs to afflict. But these are the afflictions of a truly godly man. If God hadn't said to Satan what he did say about him, well, then we might be tempted to think, well, there's obviously something not right with Job. There's obviously something that is hidden from us. God says there's none like him. He's the most godly man I know. And you're moving me, Satan, against him because he's godly. You want to tempt him because he's godly. And you want to turn me against him because he's godly. And he's tried because he's godly. Now, where do the trials begin? What's their origin? Satan, verse 12, so Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. He went forth from the presence of the Lord, and he immediately engages in using that power that God permitted him to use. All that he hath is in thy power. We would maybe think, well, he's only a creature, isn't he? He may be Satan, but he's still just a creature. Well, look at the power that he has. He is able to move the Sabaeans. Verse 15, the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword. What does Job know about the Sabaeans? Satan moved them. He had the power to move these people, to go and destroy and damage Job's wealth and materialism. Not only the Sabaeans, the Chaldeans. He has the power to move the Chaldeans. Oh, he didn't go himself and do it. He's hidden out of sight while he's doing it. It's the Sabaeans who are doing Satan's dirty work. And the Chaldeans are doing Satan's dirty work. You go to Ephesians, and there we have Paul teaching the Ephesians how important it is that they have on the whole armor of God, that they might stand against the wiles of the wicked one, having done all to stand. And we can visualize in our minds this satanic evil spirit at work. But look at how he works. Does the servant who escapes come running to Job? Job, Satan has just attacked your animals. Satan has just slain your servants and gone off with your oxen and with your asses. No, he comes, he says, the Sabaeans have done it. When the other servant comes, does he say, well, Satan has just arrived with three bands of his satanic followers, and they fell upon the camels and have carried them away? There's not a sight nor a sound of Satan as far as the human eye or human ear is able to detect. But he's there, invisibly, working in the hearts and moving these people to their destructive work in the life and the experience of Job. All that he has is in thy power. What power he has. Then, while he was speaking, verse 18, there came also another and said, thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness. Well, did that servant, did he imagine Satan was flying around Job's property and the place where Job's herds were, destroying with satanic force? All that he has is within thy power. And that wind came from Satan. These words should make us think, all that he hath is in thy power. Though his power is limited, and though his power is the power of a creature, and the power of an accountable creature, what power he can exercise, aren't you and I mighty thankful that God keeps a constraint upon him? Aren't you and I to be thankful that God, who is sovereign, restrains that power that Satan would use? What if it was unleashed against you or I? What if that power were not restrained by God? And this Satan could say, well, I'm going to use my power against that man, against that woman, there, the little Free Presbyterian congregation in Grafton. What will become of us? God restrains that power. And it amazes me how Christians don't even seem to appreciate what he's capable of doing. And even the vote that has been the postal vote, who's behind it? Why does it turn out the way? It would turn out even worse if God did not restrain things, because satanic power is behind these kind of movements. Here is a most godly man, and Satan is permitted by God to unleash against him tremendous forces and tremendous powers, because he's intending to cause Job to curse God, to destroy the relationship between Job and his God and between God and Job. Now, look at we've noted the extent of his trial. It touched every part of his life. It touched everything. We read of all his wealth, his beasts, his household, his servants, his influence. Sometimes when these portions are read, there's one party that's overlooked. There's reference made to his herds and his flocks taken from him, and his family taken from him, and eventually his health taken from him, but even his very servants are taken from him. They're slaughtered in all this onslaught. And Job has, as it were, every part of his person and his life intruded into by this satanic power. And he loses that which obviously was so, so important to him. You might think, well, when a man or a woman, a godly soul, is afflicted, God will restrain the powers that may afflict, because he doesn't afflict willingly, and therefore he will allow by degrees affliction that his people are able to contend with and cope with. But what happens here? Notice what we're told in verse 13. There was a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. What do we read then in verse 18? While he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, "Thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house." Why is this repeated? So that you and I are able to see how suddenly, how viciously Satan attacked Job. He hardly got time to take in the loss. Whenever he hears the report of further devastation and loss, and he's trying to take that in, when he hears of more devastation, it's just piling in. You would think, where is the man that has the mental strength to even cope with this? How can he cope? It is all happening in one day, as it were, in a very short period of time. And whenever it comes to the final report, what happens? You imagine Job, the Sabaeans fell, he's told, upon your servants and upon your oxen and your asses, they've slain your servants, they've taken away your beasts. And Job's mind goes, are my children safe? They've taken away my asses, my oxen, they've slain my servants. But at least I've got still my children. And then the Chaldeans come and they take away his camels and they slay his servants. And Job is thinking, it cannot get any worse. But at least they didn't take away my children. They didn't take away my sons and my daughters that mean so much to me. They're still safe. You think of the blow it had to be, the terrible blow, Job. Your sons are dead. Your children, Job, in spite of all the praying you did for them, and all the sacrificing every day that you made for them, they're gone. You can see that not only has Satan tremendous power, but he uses it brutally. Oh, he does not care. He does not sympathize with the most devastated heart. He doesn't have any compassion for the broken heart. He breaks it freely, willingly, viciously, and brutally. And he intends to break Job's heart to make him curse God. You would think Job must collapse. Job can't take any more. Surely he can't. What man, what human being can stand up to all this? Then Job arose. What's he going to do? Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. No matter what would happen. You imagine Satan, what a shock. Here's this man that he sought to just destroy. And he's worshipping God. He's worshipping God. What will it take to destroy him? Then, what did Job say? Naked came I out of my mother's womb. Naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. He's every right to do it. He's taken it all away. Wasn't the Sabians took it away? Wasn't the Babylonians that really took it away? Wasn't even Satan who took it away? God took it away. Satan moved the Sabians. Satan moved the Chaldeans. But God sovereignly overruled. And what does Job see? The very God that he wants to separate Job from, it's as though Job's coming even closer to him. And he can't get God out of Job's mind. Now, something to note, we're talking about grace, the testing and trial of grace. Grace, in reality, is the gold in the believer's witness. And there's a tendency sometimes to think grace is very strong because it's God's work in the soul. And grace is almost fatalistic. It just accepts things as God orders them. With a kind of stoic attitude. Job's trials were severe, there's no doubt about that. But they brought pain to him. There was real pain. Job rose up and rent his mantle and shaved his head. These were the demonstrations of the extent of his grief. This was his culture. God has taken away, he says. Job, you can't contradict yourself. If God has taken away, why are you rending your garment? Why, Job, are you shaving your head in grief if you're saying God's done it? God is trying Job, but the grace that God gave him and the grace of his patience doesn't in any way diminish the pain of the reality of his trial. He fell upon the ground in his grief. We're living in terrible, terrible hard times. We are living in days when godliness is diminishing rapidly, even amongst professing Christians, and it seems today any form whatever, any expression whatever, any outward demonstration of grief whatever is out of place. I grew up, and the older generation probably did the same. They grew up to attend a funeral in somber attire because they were faced with death. Death, the last enemy. And the grief was not out of place. Sorrow was real. And they put on for the occasion. I remember as a small boy, my brother and I, in our little suits, on the Lord's Day when we went to church, we had a black diamond on our, my mother sewed them onto our sleeves. Because we belonged to a mourning family. And you wore the evidences of grief. Wasn't out of place. Grief was something that belonged to human society. Sorrow belonged to human society. And it is better, the scripture says, to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of mirth. Not anymore. You don't go, you all come out in colors to celebrate. You don't grieve. You don't shed tears. You all smile and laugh and joke and have fun. That's because God has been left out of the minds of men. When the Savior went in John 11 to the grave of Lazarus, did he say to Martha and Mary, now, there's no need for all this sorrow. Come on now, Martha, come on Mary, dry up your tears. There's no need for all this. Let's celebrate the life of your brother Lazarus. He wept with them. He expressed grief along with them. And it's a sad reflection on our godless society whenever professing Christians want to act like the world, dismissing grief and every outward sign of it. Job here, tried by God, the pain of the trial was real, and the pain is going to increase. And there's nothing but the grace of God will carry Job through it, as we shall see. But here is the most godly man, and we need to take note of that. It's for his godliness he's been so tried. But we shall leave it there. May the Lord bless his word to us.